Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. Have the cold temperatures got you thinking about spring? Well, Jill Nadeau tells me that spring is 67 days away only. So now's a good time to dream about next year's garden, and our guest today has some great ideas for you. She is Ellen Ecker Ogden on the phone with us, a Vermont-based food and garden writer, kitchen garden designer. She likes to combine artistic elements with classic garden design so she can elevate your backyard vegetable garden into maybe a European-inspired kitchen garden. Her latest book is called The Complete Kitchen Garden. Great to have her along, and I hope you'll join in with your questions and comments as we move along today. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can send us an email at ideas@wpr.org or go ahead and post your question and your garden photos on our Facebook page. Love to see those photos as well. And Ellen Ecker Ogden, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
My pleasure. I'm always happy to talk about gardens.
Well, I tell you what, it's great to have you with us. And you're going to be in Wisconsin next weekend, 19th through the 20th, to talk at a Garden Vision Conference, Central Wisconsin's largest gardening conference in Wausau. Talk about that a little bit.
Yes, well, I'm very excited. Yes, it's called Garden Visions, and it's Central Wisconsin's gardening conference, and it's going to be held, maybe you can help me where it's going to be held, but I think it's going to be at the...
It's at the North Central Technical College in Wausau.
Right, and you can still register. There'll be a slow food dinner the night before featuring local food and a wonderful cook who's going to do a cooking demonstration. And then on Saturday, I will be doing the keynote at 8:30 and then also a breakout session after lunch.
I think your breakout session is Modern Designs for Old-Fashioned Gardeners, I think was the subtitle of that.
That's right. It's based on a new book I'm doing about heirloom gardening.
Well, you'll be talking about kitchen gardens in your talk.
That's right.
And what's the difference between a kitchen garden and a regular vegetable garden?
Well, I'm so glad you asked. My talk is called The Art of Growing Food because I actually was not a gardener originally. My parents were not gardeners, but I sort of eventually became a gardener. And now, of course, you know, once a gardener, always a gardener. But I was originally an art graduate, and I loved to paint. And I realized that one of the wonderful things about having a garden, especially a vegetable garden, is it's always this wonderful blank canvas for ideas, and I change it up every year and can do these wonderful swirls of colors with a tapestry of greens. And so I started realizing that a kitchen garden is a much smaller garden than a vegetable garden. I have always grown a big garden and canned and freezed and put away food for the winter, but a kitchen garden is really where you're going to be growing those delicate greens and the savory culinary herbs and perhaps some of the heirloom flowers and just the things that you really love that you can't get anyplace else but your own garden.
Well, and they're beautiful garden. Looking at your book, the photos that you have are wonderful. They're really attractive.
Thank you. Well, I mean, the whole idea is if you can turn work into play, it makes it that much more enjoyable. So when I wrote my book, The Complete Kitchen Garden, it was really all about inspiring people to look at their garden not as just a place to grow food, but really as a sanctuary, as a lovely place to go and sit on a bench and relax and appreciate all the beautiful colors and fragrances that are wafting through that garden.
It really is a lot of fun to spend time in the garden or just to sit and look at the garden, especially your gardens. They really are beautiful. Well, you have different types of kitchen garden designs. Tell us about some of them.
Well, in the book there are 15 theme garden designs, and I thought that I really have this sort of sense that every gardener has their own personality, and I start the book by really showing ways to what I call my 6 steps to success. So if you already have a garden, these steps will help you kind of tweak it a little bit to make it more enjoyable. But really where it starts is with a plan. And since every gardener has a different personality, there's the salad lover's garden, there's the edible flower garden, there's, of course, a children's garden and a chef's garden, and then the culinary herb garden and the patio garden for people who want to grow food in small spaces and in pots. So there's all kinds of different ways to kind of design that garden, but still using all the wonderful plant materials.
You know, you have a cook's garden and you have a chef's garden. And I was thinking about that and I said, well, I'm not really a chef. I'm probably more a cook. But what's the... is that the difference?
It's wonderful you should ask. I actually, nobody's asked me that question before. The truth is that I used to have a seed catalog called The Cook's Garden. And it was a mail-order seed catalog. We started it in 1984, and we were importing seeds from Europe of some of these wonderful heirloom, European heirloom salad greens, and then we had a lot of growers in the U.S. growing things for us because we realized that when you're growing food, why are you going to be growing the same thing that you can buy in the grocery store? You really need to be growing the set of regular green beans, those wonderful French haricots there, or instead of just a green leaf lettuce, how about some wonderful, French endive or chicories? And so the cook's garden is really based on my own garden because I'm a cook and my husband was the gardener. And so that's kind of how we got into it.
Well, I saw those two and I thought, well, if it has to do with the abilities of the person, I guess
no,
I'm a cook.
No, no. It's really a personal statement. And the chef's garden is actually based on a garden that I designed for a local chef who works at the Equinox Resort, which is a large hotel here near where I live. And so that was based on his garden.
Well, what are some of your favorite plants to have in a kitchen garden?
Oh, boy. Well, I kind of have... Well, first of all, I love salad greens. I think that if more people grew salad greens instead of squash and tomatoes and corn and even beans, you know, those things take up a lot of space and they take a lot of nutrition out of the soil, where salad greens, you can grow them quickly. They're wonderful in salads, or you can steam them or you put them on pasta. There's lots of things, even make smoothies with them. And they grow quickly and they're so full of rich nutrients and that we don't get from any other food. So I'd say my number one top priority is planting salad greens, and that includes chard and kale and collards, and you can sow them in early spring, and you're going to have greens in that garden all through till Thanksgiving, maybe even Christmas. They're just so versatile.
Yeah, and there you can get a lot produced. I mean, they come back.
Yes. And they're relatively disease-resistant. It's not like you have to, you know, worry about cucumber beetles or squash beetles or all those other things that attack some of those other plants. Flea beetles will come in the spring, but those are pretty innocuous, and you don't have to worry about them after probably May.
Talking today with Ellen Ecker-Ogden on this edition of Garden Talk. She will be presenting at the Central Wisconsin Gardening Conference. It's the largest, it's Central Wisconsin's largest gardening conference on January 19th and 20th. It's called Garden Visions. And of course, who else but the North Central Wisconsin Master Gardeners are serving as hosts for this event in Wausau at the North Central Technical College. Questions about gardening, I hope you'll join in. What about your garden? Have you got some ideas to share or maybe some questions to ask? How'd your garden grow last year? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. 642-1234. You can email us. The email address is ideas@wpr.org, or go ahead and post on our Facebook page. And, of course, we always love to see garden photos as well. So don't be afraid to post them as well. You mentioned it earlier on that there were kind of six steps to success. And I said that slowly because to say that fast is difficult. Six steps to success. Let's talk about some of those steps, or maybe talk about the six.
Oh, that's great. Well, I would like to add that I'll be talking about this with beautiful pictures and at the Garden Conference, and I do know that you can still get tickets to it, and I just wanted to say that I believe there's a website called Garden Visions, and also you can call Carol at 715-693-6446 to register, and I believe registration is still open until the 15th of January.
And we should definitely. We have a link. I'm pretty sure I know we have a link on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show as well for people to find that. What's the address again? The email?
Garden Vision. And it's Carol at 715-693-6446.
Okay. Well, all right. We'll certainly mention that again as we move along.
Great. But my six steps to success for turning an ordinary garden into an extraordinary garden really starts with a design plan. And I can't stress this enough. I think what happens is we get those garden seed catalogs in and we're all wanting everything we see and these lists start and we order all these seeds and then it's like, oh, where am I going to put this in? And I don't know about you, but I still get sort of suckered into it. I have seeds from years and years and years that I haven't even opened because I haven't figured out where they're going to go. But starting with a plan really starts now. It really could have started, you know, at the end of the garden season. And it's taking a fresh look at your garden design. And whether if you just have a rectangular garden with a long straight rows, you know, let's change it up a little bit. Let's get a little more modern and fun. And I don't want to say funky because, you don't want a funky garden, but you want something that's perhaps a little bit more aesthetic and elevated and perhaps sophisticated on some level. So starting with a plan is really, really important, which is why I give some ideas in my book. And I kind of hope people use my book more like a recipe book in that you look at a design and you like certain elements, but then maybe you turn the page and you see another design and you kind of like that bench that you see sitting there and maybe you'd put it's just a mix and match thing. So step number one is design, and I also I teach a class online on craftsy.com, and I always say just go out and get graph paper. You know, you don't have to get fancy. You don't need some special landscape design class. Just get a piece of graph paper, a pencil, and a ruler, and a measuring tape so you know what kind of space you're working with, and then just start doodling. It's amazing what you come up with.
Well, there's a couple of good, and we'll get through those six steps as we move along. And I know, obviously, it's going to be fun to see you do this because you're going to have some great photos and slides to show people at your presentation. So that's going to be fun. Ben in Madison has a question, so let's go to Ben.
Okay.
Ben, are you there? Let's see if we can get Ben on. Yeah, there we go. Hi, Ben.
I grew up gardening from the time I was 14. I was the gardener, and my mom is 91, and she's still gardening there. But my question is about fertilizers. My neighbor, who is Professor Love in agriculture, saw me taking rock powders out to the garden, granite dust and high calcite lime and rock phosphate. And he's like, what are you doing? And I'm like, well, I'm feeding the soil. And he's like, why would you feed the soil when you could feed the plants directly? It's because I don't want to use oil turned into fertilizer, and because you get a higher sugar content, a higher mineral content, and a higher protein content, and the food doesn't rot. Do you know anything about rock powders for fertilizer?
Wow, I love this question. I don't, but I'm certainly going to look into it. I do have opinions about soil, though, because, of course, when you're talking edibles, what feeds the plants ultimately feeds you. And I really believe that it also can affect the flavor, especially of the root crops. And so taking special care of the soil, and I don't add a lot. I always use compost, and I use cover crops because those actually add texture as well as nutrients. But let me ask you, have you had your soil tested? Is that how you happen to have come across your formula?
No, I heard about it through Acres USA, and it's just marvelous because I never use any nitrogen fertilizer. The air is 90% nitrogen, so if you have a good texture in your soil, there's going to be plenty of nitrogen in the soil.
Well, you just want to make sure things are natural, of course, and I'm an organic gardener, and I use a crop rotation where, do you know about crop rotation?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It abound where you plant your legumes in one bed and your salad crops, your green crops in another, and then your root crops and your fruiting crops, and you rotate those every year. So you're really adding.
I map them out and rotate. Yeah.
Do that already. Great. So to answer your question about specific rock phosphates, no, but I would suggest maybe getting your soil tested just so you actually know what you need, unless you don't have any problems and everything's growing just fine.
Yeah. Yeah. You should. Actually, it's something you really should do. Ben, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, by the way. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our on-air producer, as we visit with Ellen Ecker Ogden on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. So great to have you listening on this edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. Questions for our gardening guest today, Ellen Ecker Ogden. I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or go ahead and post on our Facebook page. Certainly love to hear from you. And let's see, some more callers online. We'll take those calls in just a minute here. Oh, we just lost a caller. Again, 800-642-1234. Give a call. You have a whole book that's dedicated to growing basil, growing and using basil.
Yes. At one point I was called the Baroness of Basil. well, who doesn't love basil? I mean, doesn't everybody grow basil? I just think it's probably the number one selling crop in the world, or I don't know, but I just adore basil.
How do you, you were talking about organic gardening, and you are an organic gardening, a gardener. How do you try to deal with insect or disease invasions and that sort of thing?
Well, do you want to go back to basil for a little bit?
Sure.
For a second, because I really would love to share some ideas about basil. One of us, you know, we were talking before the break about plants, and I wanted to share I have what I call my 80-20 rule, which is growing 80% tried and true things that you always grow, which would include basil and, you know, lettuce and those things that you know. Because I think we build these loyalties towards certain seed companies and things that we love. But then I really suggest trying 20% new and different, something that you never even thought of. For instance, a few years ago I started growing artichokes. Now, I'm in Vermont. Who thought you could grow artichokes in Vermont? And I was harvesting my first artichokes by my birthday in July, and I was just over the moon. And so now I grow a lot of artichokes, and I put them in my flower beds, and I've just put them everywhere because they're such a beautiful plant. And I never would have found them if I hadn't experimented. So I would really love to encourage your listeners to grow something that they've never heard of or something new and different. And so going back to your question about basil, there's over 80 different types of basil that a gardener can grow, and they're all really easy to grow from seed. There's, you know, not all of them are culinary, but many of them are. There's cinnamon basil, there's lemon basil, there's lettuce leaf basil, which grows a big leaf the size of your hand, and you can put a piece of fish in it and put it on the grill, and it will infuse it with a basil flavor. And there's tiny basil, and so just sort of branch out and try some sort of variations on the theme. It's really a fun thing to be thinking about as we're looking towards spring.
Let's take some more calls here. Ken in Mayville, you're up. Thank you for calling. Hi, Ken.
Hey, how you doing? Just a quick comment. I'm a chef for 37 years. I've been in the restaurant business. One of my favorite jobs ever was executive sommelier of the Los Angeles Country Club. And we had just started a garden. This was back in the mid-90s. They had fig trees all over the course, mulberry trees all over the course, all sorts. We would just harvest as we needed. The last time I was there visiting, the executive chef says that they don't even buy produce anymore, and they do a phenomenal amount of business. And they everything they do is just from the gardens that they have on the course. But I do have one question. When I worked in France, I got a huge affinity for mosh. It's a wonderful lettuce. It grows very well here in Wisconsin. The seeds even overwinter, which is great. My only concern is how can I grow it so it's easier to harvest? I've soon realized why mosh is so expensive. It's all in the cleaning.
Yeah.
You know, first of all, Ken, that is a great question. I adore mosh, and it's for those of you who don't know it, it's sort of a small spoon-shaped leaf that grows in a little sort of petiole, a small head, as Ken says, close to the ground, and it has a mild nutty flavor to it, and it's particularly good when it's dressed with like a hazelnut oil or something. And oddly, it's all over Europe. I mean, you go to those European farmers markets, and it's everywhere, and it's all year round, and it's always washed and beautiful, and it's so great. Yet we don't know about it here. So I'm very impressed that it's on the top of your list. That's really great.
Yeah.
In terms of washing it, I mean, it's good to harvest it close to the ground. It's not as cut and come again as many mesclunes and other cutting lettuces. And then I just think it's that I agree with you. It's probably the thing that's the hardest is it just has to be soaked in a sink full of cold water.
Yeah, and then you wind up, I always harvest it. I pull the roots, unlike what I would do with my mesclun. And, so you just have these clusters of dirt, and it's like 3-4 washings. I think the stuff they sell in the stores in France is actually just hydroponically grown.
Oh, is that it?
I wonder.
Yeah, but I'm trying to find a way of, I was actually thinking of maybe growing it in a sandy medium or something that might be a lot easier to just kind of shake off and end wash. But, yeah, it definitely is labor-intensive in the cleaning.
And so if you're a chef, that's a problem. If you're a home gardener, it's certainly worth trying because you don't need to worry so much about somebody. I mean, of course, you don't want to eat grit, but nobody's going to sue you if it's your own family.
You can put up with it. All right. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, Ken, thank you so much for calling. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Chris on Facebook has a suggestion of something he does. If you just prepare a bed and thickly scatter mixed greens seed very early in spring, you will have a salad all summer without any additional work. No weeding, just go out in the morning and pick the outer leaves, put them in the fridge in a bowl of water.
Oh, that's great. Well, that's the other thing about greens. Here we are, that we could just turn this whole conversation into a thing about greens. You can keep doing that. Mesclun and cutting mix will keep coming back again a couple times. It does get hotter. And so I actually like to have a succession of greens that I plant. And I have a quote from Thomas Jefferson where he writes in one of his journals to plant a thimbleful of lettuce every Monday morning. So if you mark that on your calendar, you could have wonderful salad greens all summer long.
I love that. I had never heard that quote before, and it's pretty true, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I think so. You know, that lettuce, a lot of lettuce doesn't like to grow in the heat, and I'm not sure how hot it gets out in Wisconsin, but probably pretty warm in the summer, right?
And August, hot and humid.
Yeah, so it doesn't germinate terribly well over 80-something degrees. So there, you have to either start little seedlings inside or water it and cover it with something to keep it cool. And I often turn to the Mediterranean varieties of lettuce and endives, chicories and endives and things, which do better in the heat. So you might have to transition into warmer climate greens.
Let's turn to another caller, Cheryl in Conover. Thanks for calling. Hi.
Turn to another caller.
Are you there, Cheryl?
Yes, I am. How are you this morning, Larry? Thanks for taking my call.
Well, great to have you along. What's on your mind today?
Well, my husband built for me this really cool above-ground garden. It's a 4x8, and it is deep enough to be able to grow food, okay?
Yeah.
And I have experimented with basil. I always get basil, but I just want to ask your guests what types of things would you plant in? This is an above ground garden, so it makes it easier to garden. I like it. I usually plant some herbs, but I tried cabbage last year and it was a total flop. And I think it was our summer. And parsley was fine. I got parsley. In fact, I have it. The thing about parsley and basil is you don't have to do anything to it. Just cut it, put it in a plastic bag, and stick it in your freezer, and you can have it all winter long. But I just wondered what other things she might recommend for that type of garden in that limited space.
All right.
Hi, Cheryl. This is Ellen.
Hi.
So you have one garden bed that's 4x8. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. So you really want, again, going back to the idea of salad greens and things, to get a succession of greens going because they will grow quickly and you'll get a lot out of them. But I would love for you to consider the design of this bed as much as the productivity. And perhaps, since it's raised bed, start by softening the edges with some alpine strawberries, which you can plant around the edges, which will drape over the side, and it will kind of mask the edging of it and sort of, bring it closer to the ground, so to speak, visually.
Cool.
And then
cool.
You'll have little strawberries all summer. And alpine are a little different than the daylight-sensitive ones, and they're tinier berries, but they will stay in place. They'll keep coming back year after year, so they're perennial. And maybe some trailing nasturtiums would be really pretty interspersed with that. So you are creating a decorative framework around the edge of that garden, which are sort of low-growing things but will also be very ornamental and edible.
Okay.
Do you... Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry. And then the other thing I would do is give it some height. So right in the center, put together some kind of a little teepee with bamboo poles to grow runner beans or cucumbers or something that grows up, because I think visually it will add some drama to something that is very horizontal. So put in some runner beans and, as I say, some things that love to grow up a trellis system, and I think that will be pretty. And then maybe some decorative planting around the edges. Maybe that's where you put in, you could even plant peas in the center there, and then later in the summer you can put in some beans so you have two separate crops growing. Because I think the key is if you have a very limited amount of garden space, you're going to want to have things that grow quickly so that you can then get another crop in as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, yes. And we also have dogs. So I have a perennial garden that's gated within our yard, and our four dogs We have a couple male dogs, so every once in a while I lose a lazy I lose a Black Susan due to one of our male dogs. So that's why we built the food garden above, because they can't get anywhere near it, and it's easier on my back.
Understood. But I like your Ellen's ideas, though, about sort of dressing it up and then getting food at the same time.
I like that idea a lot. I will certainly give it a try once we don't have snow and 14 below zero up north here.
And lots of color. Like, I love McGregor's beet, for instance, which is not really grown for its underground root, but for the red tops. And, so just think colors and textures and things and make it pretty.
Yeah.
Okay, that sounds good to me. Sounds great.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And you should consider going to the, you're closer to the Central Wisconsin Gardening Conference in Wausau on the 19th and 20th. That would be worth a trip for you, Cheryl. You can join in too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. We have another Cheryl, this one from Bessemer, Michigan. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi. I just called to comment on the artichokes. People don't believe me that you can grow them up here, but they actually like kind of cool. Certain varieties really like a little cooler weather. I had a fantastic crop, and people would argue with me. I'd say, come over to my yard. I want to show you these artichokes because they're so fancy.
Which varieties do you use?
I bought these ones at the food co-op up in Ashland, and they're specifically for zone 3 through 8. Mm-hmm. And I think you can probably find them in Johnny's Selected Seed. I just don't have them in front of me now. But they are such a beautiful plant. I was at a wool shop in around Minocqua, and I was telling the owner about them, and she kept on arguing. I said, I live in Bessemer. I said, you can use those for landscaping. They're so fancy looking.
I
have put them in planters. They are fancy. You know, and they're the type of plant that as soon as you see it, you recognize it in the back of your mind from maybe murals, pottery, fabric. It's been used in artwork forever.
You sound like a real artist. It's wonderful.
I was an artist at one time, and I do have lots of gardens, so I love to play, too. And I like to share my stuff. I go bring all the young people that are at the farmer's market doing their vinegars and stuff, I have them come over to my house, pick some herbs. I said, bring a big basket. I'm sharing. I could sell them, but I don't. I just share.
That's funny.
Anyways, all I wanted to say is about the artichokes.
Thank you, Cheryl. Okay.
You're welcome.
Well, I think it's important. I just want to add that it's a fairly long season crop. Most of the perennial artichokes, and of course they're grown, California and places that have much longer season. But the ones that I've been growing are Green Globe and also Colorado Blue Star, which is a purple artichoke. And they need to be started fairly early, like late February, March. And
I start mine when I do the tomatoes.
Oh, really? That's great. Yes, early. You start them indoors, is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Starting them indoors and then transplanting them out when they're about 4 inches high because they're fairly resistant to cold. So you can get
They like a little bit of cold.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There you go. Thank you, Cheryl.
Sure thing. You have a great weekend.
You as well. Appreciate your call. And you can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. Here's something a little different. Margaret emailed to say that this is her second year of trying to grow herbs indoors over the winter. Last year, they all died by March. And she sees her parsley, as well as oregano, is starting to die right now already. They are under a plant light for 12 hours, daytime and nighttime. House temperature is 60 degrees, and while they're home, it's 68 degrees. So she wonders about how to make her indoor plants more successful?
Do you want my answer on that?
Yeah.
You asking me? Oh, okay. you know, indoor herbs, everybody's a little different. 68 degrees doesn't sound like it's very warm, but it's sure warmer than my house. I usually keep my house around 60, and my plants are very happy because they really do like cool weather, I think, because there's a lot going on between the low light situation and the temperature and the moisture and stuff that they're not getting outdoors. Honestly, I think that sounds to me like a lot of work to be putting 12 hours of light on them and so on. And so what I prefer to do is harvest the parsley and the oregano in the fall when it's vibrant and it's still full of wonderful vitamins. And the parsley I just put in a freezer bag and put it in the freezer, and then I bring it out and use it for stews and soups or whatever it is that I would use. And the oregano, I hang it upside down, so then I have the essential oils that are I can use it from the leaves for my spaghetti sauce. So honestly, I personally wouldn't bother with the plants. I would just harvest the herbs in the fall and use them all winter long and then start over again.
There you go. Ellen Ecker Ogden, our guest today. She is has been gardening for a long, long time, Vermont-based food and garden writer, kitchen garden designer, and her book, The Complete Kitchen Garden, we're talking a bit about that as well, and also about her participation in the Garden Visions Conference on January 19th and 20th in Wausau at the North Central Technical College. Larry Mueller here for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at your garden today and talking a bit about kitchen gardens and how you might maybe transform a piece or all of your garden into a kitchen garden with our guest Ellen Ecker Ogden. She is speaking, as I mentioned, at the Garden Visions Conference, January 19th and 20th in Wausau at North Central Technical College. It's an event sponsored, hosted by the North Central Wisconsin Master Gardeners. And just to register for that event, you go to gardenvisions.info, www.gardenvisions.info. And Ellen, website is ellenogden.com. So some information for you there. And Ellen, we're going to go to Carol in Appleton next. Carol, hi. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. Thank you for your show. I'm really enjoying it. I wanted to talk about, well, I have perennial gardens all around my yard, so I don't have room for vegetables. So I started maybe 5 years ago a vegetable garden in pots and one raised bed on a second-story deck that I use. And I have had such fun with everything from tomatoes to herbs, parsley, onions, potatoes, lettuce, rosemary, strawberries hanging over the edge of a raised garden. Everything grows so well, and it's just such fun to watch.
Oh, and you have a raised bed on your balcony, your second-story balcony.
It is. It's on legs. It's manufactured. My kids gave it to me, and it's only about 3 by 5 feet. And I grow, well,
all those things
I care to that year in that bed.
Very cool. Comment on that, Ellen.
Oh, I'm very impressed. You sound like a very good gardener. The only thing I was just sort of thinking about is that there's some wonderful ornamental edibles that you can actually add into your landscape with your perennial flowers if you ever wanted to, you know, stick in rainbow chard or something, which is really lovely. Cabbages are great. Kale, blue Tuscan kale, is a gorgeous ornamental plant, and it just might be a beautiful backdrop for some bright orange zinnias or something. So, you know, you might consider some of that too if you wanted to expand.
Yeah.
I will have to try that this year.
Yeah,
problem I had, I discovered with the strawberries, that the squirrels and chipmunks have found their way up to my deck. And I generally don't ever get to eat any strawberries.
How about that? I'd love to just point out, too, that at the Garden Visions Conference, there'll be all kinds of really interesting speakers there. I'm just one, but we're going to be talking about the best blueberries and native flowering shrubs and the joy of beekeeping, hummingbird nesting, and growing the best strawberries. There's all kinds of wonderful programs to choose from, so I'd love to encourage your listeners to really take a look at the agenda for that day. It's really quite packed and full and exciting.
Yeah, it really is. Carol, thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Appreciate the call. You can join in, too. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Give a call with your questions and comments. What other kinds of fun decorative elements can you add to a kitchen garden, Ellen?
Oh, going back to the six steps to success.
Yeah.
Well, you know, when you're working on the design, it's really nice to figure out wonderful gate and fences. I think that we don't often think sometimes in terms of a fence as a way to keep things out. But if you can think about a fence around the garden as kind of a picture frame, it kind of encloses that area. So I love looking through a gate, or it sort of forms an archway, a transition from the lawn into the garden. So thinking of some way you can create something that maybe reflects the same aesthetics of your house or your neighborhood or your garden design, other garden designs.
And I like, and you've got an old bench in your book. There's a photograph of a really old bench, but it looks so inviting. Doesn't it? I mean,
I'm so glad you, Larry, pick up on all just the right things. I'm so pleased. You know, I often tell people that if you only do one thing to change your garden, put a bench in your garden, because I can't tell you how many people have these vegetable gardens. Where honestly, you know, vegetable gardening takes a certain amount of energy, and you need to have a bench to sit down on and drink your iced tea and look at, you know, be able to admire all that you do. So I say if you do only one thing, get a bench. And if you could get two benches in there, that's even better.
And benches with backs.
Oh, definitely. Something comfortable.
Right. You definitely want to do that. Oh, man. do you start your plants from seed, or do you buy seedlings? What do you do?
Well, I like to do a combination of things. I don't have a greenhouse, and I think my Vermont climate is probably like yours. When is your frost-free date there? Is it like June?
Well, we generally start. For tomatoes, for example, you might start around the third to fourth week of May, somewhere in there. And of course, your lettuce and so forth, you can start quite a bit earlier.
Right. Well, when can you set things out in the garden with a frost-free date?
I don't know the exact date of that. What's yours?
Well, we used to be generally around Memorial Day, so the first week of June. Lately, it's been pushed back quite a bit. So, but usually, you know, the end of May or something like that. So we have a very short growing season.
Yeah, ours is longer.
Yeah. Well, you know, I just feel that the growing season's so short that if I can find a plant, if I can buy my artichoke, if I can buy my tomatoes, if I can buy certain things that I like, then I will, because it gives me a jump on the season. But there's a lot of things that I can't find plants for. And, for instance, some of those unusual basils, and, of course, certain things don't like to be transplanted, like the peas and the carrots and the beets and things. So
sure.
I'll direct sow all of those. So it's kind of a 50-50 kind of arrangement.
How do you decide on, I guess I should ask you, are you planning anything new for the year for your garden in terms of vegetables, or do you kind of stay with the same?
Well, I'm going to try and use up all the seed packets I bought last year. So I haven't even opened the seed catalogs. But I'm doing this new book on heirloom garden designs. It's going to be very similar to the Complete Kitchen Garden, where there'll be theme gardens and then suggestions for things to plant that, you know, flowers, old-fashioned flowers like sweet peas and things that have wonderful fragrance, and then, of course, vegetables that have wonderful stories like the Jimmy Nardella pepper or the mortgage lifter tomato and things. So I continue to grow some of these old varieties because I'm just so curious about them, and I want to get photos of them so I can really share some of the stories with my readers and, you know, with my larger audience.
I like that a lot. Yeah, heirlooms. What is it about heirlooms that attracts you?
Well, I guess because I'm also a seed saver, so I like the idea of being able to grow the fruit or the vegetable, but also to save the seeds so I can grow them again the following year. And so I always have a supply going. I just feel that there's a certain self-sufficiency that appeals to me.
Yeah, I think there's something to that. Some people have trouble saving seeds. What procedures do you, is there anything special that you do to save those seeds from one year to the next?
Well, in terms of saving the seeds from each variety, there's whole books written about how to do that. And the Seed Savers Exchange in Iowa has a wonderful book. Do I have it right here in my bookcase? It's about seed saving, and I would highly recommend it. And there was one written years ago by Suzanne Ashworth called Seed to Seed. So there's, you know, in terms of the technical things about how to save the seeds, each plant is going to be a little different. But I don't like to save seeds in paper envelopes because I don't think that really saves them well enough. The moisture can still get in, and the temperature can fluctuate from hot and cold. So I usually use a little seed box, a glass jar, a mason jar, or I have these little seed boxes that I keep my seeds in. Because you don't need very much to just get the garden going again the following year.
Yeah, no, you really don't. And tomatoes, something like that. Do you save tomato seeds?
I have in the past, yes.
I wondered about that because I went, how do you do that? I guess you would have to clean them.
Well, you know, they're wonderful. It's wonderful. Some people just save the seeds. What we used to do when we had our seed catalog is we actually would scoop the seeds out, and then you put it in water, and then you let it ferment, and it gets this little kind of moldy top, and you have to wait for it to mold because that will really create the germination gene in the seeds. And then you lay them all, then you rinse it out, and then you lay it out to dry, and then you package it up. So there are certain procedures. Something like peppers, I think you can just scoop out the seeds and use them like that. So different things. It's a fascinating subject. You could do a whole show just on seed saving, I'm sure.
Are there things to remember? Is it important, or what is important, I should say, to remember when planting heirloom varieties? Is there anything special about them that you need to think about?
Well, you know, there is a difference. Not at all. I mean, I think heirlooms and open pollinated sort of go in the same niche as far as I'm concerned. Heirlooms are often distinguished because they're handed down and they have stories and they have names, whereas open pollinated are seeds that will come back to grow in as the same plant versus a hybrid or a GMO, which is not, you know, something that home gardeners are necessarily going to have to worry about when they're planting their gardens. But the hybrids are genetically set up so that they won't come back to be true from seed. So there's nothing, I mean, I think a lot of people prefer the modern hybrids because they claim to be more disease resistant. There's all kinds of other, you know, productivity pieces to them. But the open pollinated, I love the flavors. I love the paint. I love the, you know, I think that we've become so kind of monoculture. You go to the grocery store and you get one type of carrot, you get three types of potatoes, and you get one type of broccoli, and you forget that there's thousands and thousands of varieties that we're losing. I mean, we're losing thousands of varieties because we're not sort of protecting the diversity of the seed crops.
Yeah, and that's too bad. What are some, well, let's take something like broccoli. What are some types of varieties that you like that are just different from the one you find in the grocery store?
Well, you've probably seen that beautiful Romanesco broccoli. Looks a little bit like the spaceship. It's a pointed head. they've been showing up more in farmers markets and in fancy restaurants and stuff. And it's an old Italian heirloom called Romanesque, and it's a delicately flavored, more like a cauliflower type of plant, and it's just stunning. And I, you know, I have some on my website, and I'll show some up at my talk as well. So that would be one variety of broccoli that I really would focus on. And something like Brussels sprouts. There's a red Brussels sprout that called rubine, and it's very hard to find, but it's a gorgeous ornamental plant. And these are things that you're not finding in the grocery store because, you know, they're just people look at them and go, that's a novelty. I don't think I want to bother with that.
Oh, well,
gardener, you go, oh, my God, this is so exciting. And I have this quote in my talk that says, and it's funny you should pick broccoli out, that's, listen to your broccoli, and your broccoli will tell you how to eat it. Because, you know, I think that when you've grown broccoli and it takes 95 days from seed to plant, you're going to take such special care of that broccoli, and you're just going to steam it lightly and put a little lemon butter on, and it's you're going to really taste that flavor. And if you're just buying broccoli from the grocery store, like I did last night, I confess, and I overcook it and I put it sauce on with lots of garlic crouton and stuff because it doesn't have a lot of flavor, so the flavor has to come from other places. So I just think homegrown vegetables, there's just, you know, to really accentuate the flavor by just dressing it lightly.
And Brussels sprouts, my daughter loves, and I love Brussels sprouts, but rubine, did you say, was the...
Yes, it was a red Brussels sprout.
I have got to see if I can find... rubine and try that out because the regular Brussels sprouts are great, but something new and something different, it's always fun to be able to try something new. And so rubine is something maybe I'll give a try. Our guest today, Ellen Ecker Ogden, Vermont-based food and garden writer and special speaker at Garden Visions 2018, January 19th and 20th. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Today we're talking about kitchen gardens, taking your questions about designing with edibles, perhaps. Our guest, Ellen Ecker Ogden, Vermont-based food and garden writer, kitchen garden designer. She likes to combine artistic elements with classic garden design. And that could elevate a backyard vegetable garden into a European-inspired kitchen garden. Her latest book is called The Complete Kitchen Garden. I hope you'll join in with your own questions about growing vegetables, herbs, edible flowers. How about heirloom vegetables? What are your favorites? Join in at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post questions or photos, garden photos, on our Facebook page. Love to see them as well. And let's go back to the phones and take some more calls. Stella in Sturgeon Bay, your turn. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I have a couple things. One, we have chickens. And we have a pen in the backyard for the summer pen, and during the winter we have a pen up near the house for their winter quarters. And in the fall, what we do is we fill that pen with leaves about thigh deep, and then we put straw over it, and the girls just scratch away, and what it's called a deep litter system. And for one thing, that prevents it smelling, which is very nice.
Mm-hmm.
And then comes springtime, and then during the winter, we just keep adding. We give them a bale of straw periodically because they love it to scratch through it. And then in the spring, we clear all of that bedding out, compost it, and the next year, we use that for potting soil for starting the plants. And then in the pen over the summer, we found a squash. It's called Argonaut. It is a hybrid, but it's worth it.
Mm.
It grows squash, so we grow it in the pen so we don't have to contend with squirrels and rabbits attacking the plants. And it grows squash that are about 40 pounds, and they're wonderful keepers. It's a winter squash, and it keeps through the whole winter, and it tastes reminiscent of a butternut. It's just a really, really delicious squash. And the other thing I wanted to mention is that we've grown artichokes, and when we first grew them, we planted them in containers, and they didn't do well. And then we planted them in directly in the soil, and they just throve. And we discovered that they like to have their feet cold. They don't like to have their feet warm.
Well, you raise a lot of things here, Stella. Comments from you, Ellen.
Oh, that sounds like a perfect place to live with your chickens and their summer and winter home. That's so nice. Yes, I agree with you about artichokes. I think they have like a taproot also. It's like a really deep root. So, yeah, growing them right in the soil makes sense. And I love the suggestion of the argonaut squash, and I'll have to give that a try. Thank you.
Yeah, that was a I didn't know that squash, or I don't know that squash. I'll have to look into that as well. Thank you, Stella. Here, appreciate your call. Leanne in Princeton is up next. Hi, Leanne. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Ellen. Nice to talk to you. I would, as you were mentioning, the Rubine Russell sprouts and the Romanesco broccoli, I happen to have my Baker's Creek rare heirloom seed catalog open to page 21, and they were both on there. You guys inspired me this morning to start my garden planning, and I spend most of the winter doing that, but I wanted to let you know I had grown some beautiful pumpkins this year. I grew a French heirloom Cinderella pumpkin that I ended up cooking up and harvesting 36 cups of pulp from it. And I put it in the freezer, and it's just beautiful. And it tasted almost raw, like a cross between a little watermelon and cantaloupe in the flavoring. It was just phenomenal.
And what was the name of it again?
It was an heirloom pumpkin it's called a Cinderella, and it's got a French name, and I'm going to ask her.
It's called a Rouge Vif d'Etang.
Yes.
Is the French name for it. And it's a flat top pumpkin, and it's actually got thinner. I'm surprised you cooked with it. I actually haven't found it to be that good in the kitchen because it's got it's much thinner than a pie pumpkin or other types. But, of course, anything French is going to taste good, so I don't doubt.
It was interesting because I kept it until just a couple weeks ago. It was beautiful, and what I did was I cut it rib, because it was so huge, I cut it rib by rib, and then I peeled it, and then I chunked it, and then I ended up, because I wanted to can it, and that's kind of an iffy thing, too, sometimes, unless you do it the right way. But I baked it down in a pot in a Dutch oven and on the stovetop, one in the oven, one on the stovetop, and it was just beautiful. And I just like it with a little butter and salt and pepper, a little garlic on there, just savory, and it was just wonderful. But I actually made some soup out of some of it, and it was almost too sweet. It was extremely sweet, and I will grow them again. And one thing, too, though, if a person's growing them, they grow upside down, and I accidentally snapped a couple off because I thought maybe I'd have to right them right side up. No, don't. Just let them grow upside down.
And I never heard that. I didn't realize that.
Oh. So I snapped two of them off, and I felt so bad. just leave them alone.
That's okay.
Well, thank you so much.
Leanne, thank you so much. It's great talking with you. Appreciate your call.
Yes. I just wanted to say something about seed catalogs and that she had mentioned Baker's Creek, which has a wonderful collection of selection of heirloom varieties and really gorgeous color photographs. But there's a lot of other seed companies, too. And I really like the idea of supporting small local seed companies whenever possible. There's a wide range of wonderful companies that you may not have even heard about. So really branch your wings out and look at some other ones. And, of course, there's the Seed Savers in Decorah, Iowa. And around here we have the Hudson Valley Seed Company and High Mowing in Vermont. And Johnny Selected, somebody had mentioned that earlier. So just take a look at a lot of different seed companies and you know, try a little bit from each one if you can.
Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Maybe you've got an idea or a question for our guest today, Ellen Ecker-Ogden. Love to hear from you. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Jane from Kenosha called, and this goes back to the chef who called earlier about growing greens, and she suggested that the chef grow his greens in straw bales. I've done quite a bit of straw bale gardening myself and enjoy it. Have you tried straw bale gardening at all, Ellen?
Well, I have a little issue with straw bale gardening. I mean, I like the idea, and I think it's good for space, space saving. Since I'm focused on design,
yeah,
they're not always the most aesthetic. I mean, you can certainly make them the way, but my understanding about straw bale is you put a bunch of, I mean, tell me how it works, Larry. You tell me about it, but I think you start with fertilizer or something, right? And it's not really soil you're working with.
What you do is you add some fertilizer in the beginning to sort of get the bale started in the spring,
mm-hmm.
And you water regularly, and the bale starts to decompose,
mm-hmm.
and it provides its own nutrients in the act of decomposing. Now with I grow tomatoes on straw bale I'll do some other things as well, but you certainly can grow greens in straw bales, but you do need to provide some dirt of some sort to get the seed started for sure. And I've had very good luck with it.
Yeah. I guess, you know, I just keep going back to this thing, what you feed your plants ultimately feeds you, and it just seems to me that if you're working with really beautiful garden soil that's been nurtured with compost and cover crops and things, you're just going to be getting the best nutrition possible, where you don't necessarily know where the hay was grown or the fertilizer, and I think it sounds fine for maybe flowers and ornamentals, but I don't think I wouldn't plant salad greens in it myself.
Cher on Facebook asks, what is the ideal depth front to back for a raised bed? It will be against, she has one that would be against a brick courtyard wall, so there'd be access only from one side.
Yeah. Well, you don't want it any wider than you can reach, like 4 feet, I guess, would be. You know, put your arm out, and that should go to the center of a bed if you can get on it from all sides. But if you can't get it from all sides, probably no more than 3 feet deep. I stumble on this question about raised beds, and if you come to my talk at the Garden Visions, you'll hear my theory on raised beds. Again, you know, I think one of the beautiful things about growing a food garden is you have this blank canvas for ideas every year, and when you're really locking yourself into a raised bed, it kind of is a place to grow food, but it's not necessarily a kitchen garden design. And so making sure it has ornamental qualities and it really fits into the landscape and it's aesthetically pleasing. And oftentimes I see raised beds, and I have to be honest, you know, they're 4x8 and they're kind of lined up in a row, and they just don't fit into the landscape all that well. So, you know, making sure that it does fit the space nicely and aesthetically, and and planting it with some interesting things to make it look beautiful.
Karen emailed to ask the name of the basil with the large leaves that you wrap food in and grill.
Oh, good. That's called a mammoth leaf basil. And it's Italian, and there's a seed company in Kansas, I believe, that's called Seeds of Italy, and they import a lot of Italian salad greens. But you can also get one, I think it's a lettuce leaf basil, but if you can get the, you know, original Italian mammoth basil, I think that would be the best one.
Let's go to Claire next in Brookfield. Claire, hi, thank you for calling.
Hello. When we were in Norway, we noticed all the row covers over the crops, fields of crops, trying to extend the growing season. And I want to know, what's a possibility for Wisconsin to extend our growing season with row covers, or what possibilities are there?
How do you extend your season, Ellen?
Well, I must confess I don't extend it that much. But and Larry, you probably have some ideas on this, but the row covers are readily available. It's a Rimae fabric. It's kind of a, you know, it's a non-woven fabric, if that makes sense. It sounds sort of like an oxymoron, a non-woven fabric. But you can get them through Johnny's catalogs and other places, and those are really good in the spring to keep the flea beetles off. I don't know if they create that much warmth, except if you're protecting from a light frost, but certainly any kind of hotbed, which what they used to use as little seed saving seed. Help me out here, Larry. I'm starting to lose my vocabulary.
Basically, I don't remember them being used as season extenders. I think you're exactly right when you're talking about protecting against certain insects at different times of the year. They can be quite helpful. And maybe somebody else has some ideas on it, can call in and educate both of us. But I think that's basically how or why they're used. So I don't know that we can help you any much more than that, Claire. Thank you, though, for calling. Appreciate it. Carol in Randolph emailed to say that the bench in his garden or her garden is a lounge chair, but he barely uses it because he'd rather be gardening.
I have to confess, I love to sit on my bench at night. You know, there's so many beautiful night noises going on out there with the tree frogs and the crickets, and it's just a magical time to sit in the garden at night and sit very still. And there's all kinds of things that are going on that we don't see during the day.
What about, I want to go back to some of the various garden types that you have in your book. And one of them was a children's garden. And mm-hmm. Talk about the philosophy of that and what you typically would grow in it.
Oh, well, being a parent myself, you know, we love to encourage our kids to be gardeners. And I was also an active parent in their school and got a school garden program going. So I just think that's really important to make the tie-in to the schools. And, yes, both my kids are grown and they are gardeners and they love to garden. But one of the things we did is we put a playhouse in the garden. So it turned work into play. So we have to watch our vocabulary. I think that word work enters into our vocabulary more than it needs to. And we'd say, instead of saying we're going out to work in the garden, we'd say we're going out to play in the garden. Do you want to come along? And they'd come and they'd be in their playhouse, and they'd engage, and they'd bring their kittens, and you know they had all kinds of little games they would play, and so they associated being in the garden with something, a place that was really fun.
I'd like that idea, a little playhouse or a little area to play for them, but then certain types of vegetables or herbs that they could also kind of touch and maybe taste and play with while they're out there.
Oh, of course, and that's really their choice. I mean, my son loved spinach and carrots and black hollyhocks, and my daughter loved to grow gladiolas and tomatoes and peas and things. So letting them choose what they like to eat and let them just graze. You know, that's the best way to get them. Unfortunately, the problem is that you spoil them. Once they've had a real carrot, they won't be able to eat anything from the grocery store.
There really is a difference, isn't there? Boy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let's go to Kim in Whitehall next. Hi, Kim.
Hello.
Thanks for calling.
I want to comment on your guest, how she rather doesn't care for raised beds or straw bale gardens. And I understand that she likes pretty gardens, but not all of us have good quality soil. And an area where we are, it's all clay and shale. And a raised bed garden allows us to ameliorate that soil properly. Straw bale gardens, they compost nicely inside. It's a nice, rich compost. And we use the straw bales after they've composted to add to our raised beds to make that soil better. So pretty doesn't always grow better vegetables.
There you go.
No, I totally agree. I totally agree with you, and I hear you. And I know it sounds like I'm being snobby, but my focus for the talk I'm giving and for my books is on creating a more beautiful garden. But I totally agree with you that soil is king, and we have to do what we can do to make sure that things grow well.
Yeah.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Kim, for calling. Appreciate that call for sure. Corey on Facebook responded to a listener who mentioned soft rock phosphates and if they were useful in organic gardening practices. The answer, Corey says, is yes, because they give the fungal the fungal hyphae something to latch onto in the soil food web. Any rock that dust will do that, even pulverized granite, or he uses azomite. The fungi he's talking about are essential and primary part of any soil food web. An expert organic gardener will tell you they feed the soil and not the plant.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Well, I actually looked them up because I'm curious about them, and I think they're worth looking into. I definitely do, and I really appreciate that call and that information. You know, as gardeners, we're always learning. I just feel like I know nothing, and I've been gardening for 35 years, and I think we're always learning from other gardeners. So I so appreciate that information. Thank you.
Every Friday on this program, the show is called Garden Talk, so we talk about gardening every Friday, and it's amazing how much you learn and how much you learn from callers. They often have great ideas. We have a lot of master gardeners who listen to the show as well. And in fact, master gardeners can get credit for listening to the Garden Talk show. They need to have a certain number of hours of education hours. And this particular show helps fill that bill for them. So I'm a big fan of master gardeners. And I want to go back to North Central Wisconsin Master Gardeners who are hosting the Garden Visions Conference that we've been talking about, January 19th and 20th in Wausau, and it's going to be held at the North Central Technical College, and UW Extension's involved as well along with it. And the Master Gardeners from the North Central region are sponsoring it. And talk a bit more again, Ellen, about what you're talking about and what else people will be able to learn about there.
Well, it's a very impressive conference. There's all kinds of really good speakers who are going to be there. They're going to be talking about fun and easy landscape ideas, growing the best blueberries, native flowering shrubs, the joy of beekeeping. I'm just sort of reading this off of the morning session. And in the afternoon, there'll be hummingbird nesting and growing the best strawberries and shade gardens and vertical gardening and wild edibles. So, I mean, I think there's something for everybody at this wonderful Garden Visions workshop conference.
And you're the keynoter, and then you're also hosting one of the sessions as well.
That's right. I'll be speaking on the art of growing food. So this is really how to design a kitchen garden and make it kind of your sanctuary space. It's more than just a place to grow food, but it's really a place to sort of get away from everything. It's kind of a really special relationship with nature and with your landscape. And in the afternoon, I'll be talking about the new heirloom garden, which are modern designs for old-fashioned gardeners.
I think it's going to be a whole lot of fun. And, boy, I really want to thank you for taking time to be with us today and talking about gardening, the kitchen gardens, and about that event. Thank you so much, Ellen, for being with us
today. It's been a pleasure, and to all your listeners, you just keep on gardening. You sound like you all know what you're doing and you're having fun, so that's important.
Ellen Ecker, Ogden, Vermont-based food and garden writer, our guest today. She's been doing it for a long, long time, and she likes to design gardens that combine artistic elements with classic garden design. Her book, The Complete Kitchen Garden. Go to gardenvisions.info for more on the event, and ellenogden.com for her site.